Nobody cares about this but myself, but happy official 1 year anniversary of the SMS. We are back on opening day of Major League Baseball for the second year in a row. And last year it was my guy Jeffrey Passan and Alex Singleton, who ended up finishing, what was it, third in the NFL in tackles with 177 stops last year for the Denver Broncos. Their season did not go the way they expected or planned, but simply unreal year for Singleton. And good things happen when you come on the SMS. That's a note to all the future guests. Good things will happen to you when you SMS it up. It's hard to top those two guests a year later, but we've got a legend and three-time World Series winner and 1989 World Series MVP, Dave Stewart. He talks about the stare. We've got 1993 stories. We've got Kirk Gibson stories. A ton of cool stuff with a guy who essentially I grew up watching in the early 90s. And then we've got Kevin Pillar, who nobody needs an introduction for this guy. We had Justin Smoke on the show last time. This time we got Pillar, who actually takes us through an early morning drive through the desert from his home to the Chicago White Sox complex. So, spring 16. Enjoy the 2024 baseball season and enjoy these conversations.
All right, this is an absolute pleasure. Joined by Dave, Smoke, Stewart. One of my faves growing up for a lot of reasons, the intensity, the competitiveness. I think that is probably how everyone remembers you. Thanks for joining the show, pal. I appreciate it.
Appreciate you having me on, man.
Normally I kind of start, at the beginning of a career or something like that, but you got some really cool things going on right now. Want to start right with kind of what's going on in Nashville. You're a guy that's kind of spearheading the charge to bring an MLB team to Nashville. Call it the Nashville Stars. I'll let you explain kind of what the meaning behind that is. But I saw you at the winter meetings in Nashville. Kind of talk to me about what this project means to you and where things are at as of today.
Yeah, it's crazy. And I want to make a correction. The Nashville Stars Group, which is Music City Baseball, I have separated from that group and have decided to move this process forward with my group, which is Smoke 34. Still the same intent. We're doing expansion baseball, which in conversations with the commissioner and the commissioner's office, we've talked about hopefully being able to get this process started in 2029. We've got the basic agreement, the collective bargaining agreement, which is coming up in 26, and who knows how that's going to turn out. It's going to be a heavy negotiation and serious discussions between the players and management to try to figure that out. We think in this period of time when salaries are at an all-time high and the revenues are at an all-time high that we should be able to avoid any type of work stoppage, but you just never know with these things. I've been through quite a few of them myself through in playing time. So, to get back on topic, that's primary and foremost for Major League Baseball. And then I think after that, and then once that decision is made, we should be able to move forward with expansion baseball in Nashville. It's a great city. All indications would show that the city will be selected for MLB in expansion. The growth, the entertainment, tourism. They already support three major sports, soccer, hockey, and the Titans football. And so it would appear that Major League Baseball is right behind.
What does it mean to you personally?
Well, I mean, what we're standing for and what we're trying to do is, in the true meaning of diversity, we're trying to be the first diverse ownership group in Major League Baseball, majority, minority, Black-owned. But with a true focus on diversity, people say, "Well, what does that mean?" It means that when we walk through the offices of our entity and of our organization, You've got men, women, black, white, Asian, all nationalities of people, not just in office positions, secretaries or whatever those assistants, but in decision-making positions. And it's always been my intent, and through the things that I've learned growing up, that we can continue to do things with one vision, or we can start doing things with multiple ideas and multiple visions, and come up with the right process to make the best possible decisions. And that's what our plan is with Smoke 34.
So you mentioned your background a little bit there. I wanted to get your perspective as well. You were a guy who grew up in Oakland in Oaktown, born and raised. I read that you used to kind of jump the Coliseum walls to watch games. Obviously, there's a lot going on with that franchise right now. What are your thoughts on, the A's packing up potentially and moving to Las Vegas? Is it sad for you to see that likely move, or what are your emotions around that?
It's very sad. I can't say they were my first team. They weren't. The Giants were my first team because there was no A's before 1968. But after the 19 when the 1968 season came, watching the Coliseum and watching the Coliseum Arena both being built in my backyard, it brought excitement to the area. After the Coliseum was built, the area flourished. There was the Eastmont Mall came slightly after that, which, allowed us a shopping center. Back in the days, JCPenney's was the deal, and so we had a JCPenney's with a bunch of little boutique shops at that shopping center. So it wasn't just the Coliseum and the A's coming, but it meant that the area was going to flourish, and there were going to be businesses and employment opportunities. And so now, with the A's leaving, obviously, it's really disheartening. I watched the 72, 73, and 74 teams, grew lifelong relationships that I still continue to have with Reggie Jackson, Rick Mundy, Billy North, some of the guys that played on those teams. Dave Duncan was my pitching coach. And so, when you look back on the memories, that's a almost forgot Joe Rudy, who's also a close friend as well. So when you look back on those relationships that were built when I was 11 or 12 years old, and the legacy and the tradition of winning baseball, to watch Charles Finley, probably one of the best marketing people in the game, do and produce the things that he did in the Bay Area. It's really difficult to see them leave. You try not to, I try to look at things from both angles, I guess is the best way to put it. And, where you have a negotiation, it takes two people to come up with an agreement. So, I place blame on the city. I place blame on the A's. I place blame on both of them to not be able to figure out a way to make it work that they could stay in the city of Oakland.
Do you think it's a foregone conclusion at this point?
I don't see how you can reverse the process, quite frankly. I mean, I'm not as intimate with it, as the people that are obviously steering this thing, but my ears are pretty close to what's going on inside of Major League Baseball, and it would take a miracle at this point for the A's not to move to Vegas.
So moving to back to Oakland for you personally, what was it like growing up in the 1960s and 70s in Oakland?
Man, in the 60s, and like I said, we go, I'm born in 57, so I got all of the 60s, Oakland in particular was a very progressive area and in a lot of different ways. And if you include the whole Bay Area, you have to, bring Berkeley into that too. And Berkeley was a hub for anything, demonstrations about anything that was taking place in this country. You can find the people in Berkeley having a powwow about it. East Oakland, which is where I grew up, was the center for the Black Panther Party, and we all know what they stood for. Simeonese Liberation Army started in the Bay Area, and it was just, when you speak about civil rights, you have to talk about the Bay Area as being one of the primary areas for the civil rights movement. Obviously, if we go to Atlanta, you look at Dr. Martin Luther King, and then you go up to New York, you look at Malcolm X. So there was a lot going on at that period of time, and all those things seemed to resonate in the area that I grew up in, which was East Oakland.
So I read your father. He was a longshoreman. He didn't even really want you to play sports. You were kind of shepherded along by your brother. What was that dynamic like?
It was crazy. My dad really wanted us as kids, all of us, to do and be a part of something, whether it was athletics or, one of the rules in our house is that we all had to learn how to play an instrument. And so my first instrument was a trumpet, and I went from a trumpet to a clarinet, clarinet to saxophone. My brother played the drums. My sister played the violin. That was an experience in itself to listen at that squealing noise every day. There's six girls, me and my brother, and we all played instruments. So it was in our family that we all had to have some type of hobby. My dad wasn't opposed to baseball. My first baseball game was in '62, when I got a chance to see Willie Mays. And the Pittsburgh Pirates, which would have been Roberto Clemente. And that was bat day. And it was my first introduction to a professional athlete, which was Willie Mays. And so my dad was a baseball fan. And I think you would find that most Black families in the 50s, 40s, 50s, and 60s, it all started with Jackie Robinson. And then it went from Jackie to, Willie Mays or Hank Aaron, or in my dad's time, it would have been, he saw Jackie Robinson and he saw Willie Mays and Hank Aaron and the greats of the game, Mickey Mantle, all of the greats in the game. And so he wasn't opposed to baseball. He was just opposed to me playing baseball. And as a, coming up, he just said it as he thought it. Which was when, I talked about playing baseball as a professional, as a profession. He was, you're not gonna make a living hitting a ball with a stick. And that was his thing. And if you know longshoremen, they're hardworking people. My mother was a cannery worker when she first came to California. And so it my family, it was really ingrained in us that you go to school, and when you finish with high school, you go to college, because your best opportunity in this world is to have a strong education. And that's what they believed in. So it wasn't so much about playing a sport as much as it was about going to school, getting an education, and having something solid, a foundation, as he would call it, to put myself at the next level in this world. And so, he was not happy when I used to go around telling people, when asked, well, what do you want to be when you grow up? Going around telling people, I want to be a baseball player. That was not something he wanted to hear.
I heard baseball wasn't even your best sport. You had numerous football scholarships, tight end, linebacker. You ever think of if you would have played football and taken one of those offers? And if you look back on those offers, which one would have been the most enticing for you?
And I was graduated from high school at 5'10". I had no idea I would grow to be 6'2". My dad wasn't was sub 6 feet, and so was my mom. And so I had no reason to believe that I would grow, to be 6'2". I was about 5 when I graduated, and I weighed about 190 pounds, which was perfect for the linebacker position. And probably the position that I excelled at. You know, I had you're right, I had numerous college offers to go and play, and did college visitations. And after I did the visitations, you know, seeing guys that were 6'5", 270, 280, you know, it caused me to think if that was the right path for me. But ultimately, I had narrowed it down to Cal Berkeley, and USC. And if I was going to go to school, I probably would have gone to SC, because at that time, you know, SC was the college program that you'd want to be a part of, and they were putting more people from the college ranks into the professional ranks, and so SC would have been the school.
So what was it about baseball that you just said, look, this is my path? And you know, you were drafted by the Dodgers in the 16th round in 1975, and you know, you decided to sign with them rather than go the football route.
Well, it like I said, the truth be told, I wasn't confident that I would be big enough to play. You know, SC had talked about moving me to a safety position, which probably would have been more suitable for me at that time. But after I had visited with all of the colleges that were in mind to go to, I'd come home and I told my mom, I don't think that I'm big enough. And I was hoping that, you know, something happened in the draft. And, you know, two weeks after the draft, I still didn't know that I had been drafted by the Dodgers.
Really?
Yeah, my sister, by accident, was reading a newspaper and saw my name in there and said that I had been drafted. And this was 2 weeks after the draft. And another week after that, so it's a 3 week total period of time, is when the Dodgers first came into my house. So, you know, knowing, you know, had I known that summer I was going to grow above 6 feet, and then in another year I'd be 6'2". So in 2 years, you know, I grew 3, 4 inches. Had I known that, I probably would have played football. And because I like the sport, I like the aggressiveness. You know, just it was more in tune with who I was as an athlete. And then, you know, the second piece about baseball is, you know, I was drafted as a catcher. And then when I got to rookie ball, to sh when I show when I showed up, it was the first time I knew I was going to pitch. And so, you know, that was another thing against baseball. And actually, I tried not to play baseball at that time. I told my mom, you know, I was coming home, and she would not allow me to come back home. So
Smart mother.
I was kind of thrown into baseball, is the way I ended up playing, because you know, I wasn't left with any other choice.
So you mentioned that, you know, you're a two-way guy, like a lot of prospects, even today in high school, you know, hitting, things like that. What do you remember about that transition? You mentioned you didn't want to do it, but what was it, you know, when you got on the mound, were you like, okay, you know, this might work?
Well, I definitely didn't think it was going to work when I got on the mound, because I went 2 years without winning a game. No, I had more walks than innings pitched. I mean, it was a challenge. It was really a challenge. The Dodgers obviously knew something that I didn't know, because they continued to bring me to instructional league. They brought me to instructional league after the 75 season, and I ended up going to instructional league after the 76 season. You know, and then I crossed path with Sandy Koufax, and when I crossed path with Sandy, you know, it changed the course of my career, quite frankly. You know, after Instructional League 76 going into the 77 season, I ended up winning 18 games. I was 18-4. So 2 years of not winning games, then a year of having at least having that type of season, you know, making an all-star team. I think I was voted MVP in the league that year, in the Midwest League. It just changed the course of my career. So baseball was all of a sudden fun versus, a struggle, and it was a job before the 77 season. I really had to work hard at it. And don't get me wrong, I continue to work at it for a career, but the first 2 years, I wasn't sure that baseball was going to be my path.
So you finally get to the big league September 22nd, 1978, in relief against the San Diego Padres. First of all, like, what stands out about that day? And then how do you feel about the next 2 years? Because you had to go back to AAA after that one appearance, and you didn't show up back in the big leagues again until kind of establishing yourself in the bullpen in 1981. So what was that period like for you?
Well, getting called up, especially after the first, after 75 and 76 season, and then, getting called up in 78 was like a dream come true. And you take a deep breath, because you finally got there. And quite frankly, to get there in 3 years is pretty quick. But pitched, I think I pitched in one game, and it was a September call up. Go to spring training, and when you go to spring training, everybody thinks after the type of year that I had, and even in 78 in San Antonio was a 15-win season, I believe. You kind of think, you're on the right path. So I come to spring training, and I think I'm going to get an opportunity, and I do. They pitched me in spring training, and I had some good outings in spring training. But when I got sent back after spring training, and I'm going to Albuquerque, New Mexico, I didn't have Albuquerque. First of all, is not the easiest place to pitch in the Pacific Coast League. They called it the launching pad, and I found that out. I had a 5 ERA and I think 11 and 11 or 12 and 12 season. A lot of innings pitched. And to be honest, I wasn't expecting to get called up at the end of the season, because for me, it was not a good year. But then in the 80 season, I led the Pacific Coast League in everything. Innings pitch, wins, complete games, everything. And I didn't get called up. I wasn't real happy with the organization at that time. And I kind of got the message of what they were thinking about me or how they felt about me at that time. And sure enough, I come to spring training in 81 and have a great spring training. And they were going to, I was out of options, and they were going to try to send me back to AAA. And that's when I took my stance and I said, look, I'm not going back to AAA. I don't have anything to prove there. And so you're going to have to figure out what you want to do, but I'm not going back there. And, they asked me what I was going to do. And I came from a hardworking family. The job that I carried, jobs that I carried, even in the off seasons, if I wasn't playing winter ball, I was a mechanic and I worked at the Boys and Girls Club. So it's not like work is a foreign subject to me, And so they were going to send me back to the Pacific Coast League for the third time. And I said I wasn't going to go. And when they said, well, what are you going to do? I said, bro, you'll find me at home. I'll be at home. I got jobs waiting for me there that right at that time were paying me more than I was making in the minor leagues. So, I spent a full day at the hotel because Tommy had told me to just go back to the hotel and wait, and that they would get in touch with me. So I spent the full day at the hotel, and they ended up calling me at about 7 in the evening, and I told me to come back to Dodger Stadium, which I went back to Dodger Stadium, and that's when they told me that they had released Don Stanhouse and that I was going to make the team. And that's the story with how I made the Major League Club in 81. I knew I wasn't going to start. Did I think I should be starting? Yes, because I had great minor league starting numbers. And so, but they said that that's the only way I could make the team. And so I did. And I pitched out of the bullpen. And, you know, it baffles me when people say that I struggled my first few years in the big leagues, but the numbers don't indicate that. You know, I had a struggle in Texas, and Philadelphia. We don't even count that because I wasn't there long enough. So the only struggles were in Texas. The 3 years I was with the Dodgers were good years, really good seasons. But in, you know, back of my mind, I always felt that if I got an opportunity to start, I'd be ready for it. And, you know, fortunately, Philadelphia released me, got signed by the A's, and that told the story.
So 1981, still, there's two notable things that happened. First is the Fernando Valenzuela hoopla. You know, him bursting onto the scene. I think I don't even know what it was. Five, six, seven, eight shutouts he pitched that year. And then also the strike. What did you do during the strike, first of all? Because obviously players aren't making millions back then, and you probably had to make a living.
Yeah, minimum salary back then was $21,500. So in my first year, that's what I was making, and I had a wife and two kids at that time. And so when we went on strike, I worked at a company called Smith Fasteners. The owner was Brad Jenkins, and it's funny how you meet people. I was at a game, and I was kind of walking down the third baseline from batting practice into the clubhouse. There's a guy hollering, hey, Smoke. He called me Smoke. And I walked over to him and he says, gave me his card. He says, here, take my card. You never know. You guys go on strike, you might need a job. And sure enough, after about 30 days into the strike, I ended up giving him a call. And so I ended up working for Smith Fasteners for about 30 days, another month. And then we were all of a sudden done. You know, Dusty Baker was really helpful during that strike too. I borrowed money from Dusty back then to try to stay above water. So that's, you know, teammate, and Dusty's still like a brother to me today. But you know, veteran players, you know, Davey Lopes was a part of that, Reggie Smith, they were there if we needed them.
Dusty must have really liked you because I did read the story about how you wanted number 12 and you told him you were going to be four times better than
That
him.
was in of 77 or 78, and we had just gotten him from the Atlanta Braves, and I came into the locker room, and the number 12 that I had been wearing was all of a sudden gone. I did tell him that. I said, "Shoot, man, give me my number." He said, "Who are you?" I told him who I was. He says, "Man, you don't know who I am." I said, "I have no idea who you are. I just know you're wearing my number." And he told me to go to my locker, just get a, he's been in the big leagues, just get away from me, go back to your locker. And I went over to my locker and I sat my thought on it for a minute. And I came back. I said, "You know what? You can keep that number. I'm four times better than you anyway. I'm wearing number 48.
What a story. What a story. So you end up getting back to work that year, and then you go to the World Series. You win your first ring, beat the Yankees in six games. Like you said, you're in the bullpen then. What is that, what does that World Series mean to you?
Well, I'll tell you what, I felt like I was almost the reason we weren't going to win because I lost the first two games against Houston. And then I picked up two losses, if memory serves me right, in Montreal. And we came back and we won both those series with our backs against the wall. Lasorda got smart and didn't pitch me until he had to against the Yankees. And we ended up winning a World Series. And, you know, I didn't feel very significant at that time. I was glad to be a part of that team and glad that we won for sure. But I didn't feel very significant. I was glad for our team, but really, really sad that I didn't perform.
So you kind of touched on earlier, you're traded to the Texas Rangers mid-August 1983. You finally get a chance to be a starter. Kind of mixed results a little bit in terms of the numbers. You traded to Philly September 1985. That didn't go the way you wanted. You're released in May of 86. What's going on in your head at that point in terms of kind of how you're viewing your career?
Well, I mean, my agent called, asked me what I wanted to do. I was already in New Jersey, Cherry Hill, New Jersey. And was sitting around, and I told him, you know what? Truth, I said, man, this game is not fair. In Philadelphia, I looked at the guys around me, and I was saying, if these guys are better than me, literally, I said, I'll kiss your ass. And that's what I told him. I said, I started running off the names, and only two names that I felt deserved to be, in the starting rotation in front of me were Christensen and Christensen and Carlton. That's the only people I felt deserved to be in a rotation in front of me. So I ended up only making the team because Kent Taccobi started the season on the disabled list. If he had not started on the disabled list, I probably would have gotten released in spring training. Talking to my agent, I said, hey, whatever you want to do, just let me know. I'll be here. I'm gonna stay here for about 10 days, and then I'm gonna, make my way back home. So I was really indifferent, man. I didn't care one way or another. I still had another year left on my contract for about 900,000. And so, if I'd have sat out the rest of that year, once again, I'd have been back in Oakland. It wasn't like I didn't have a skill, and I'd been trained to do a lot of things, mostly work on cars, and mechanics made good money. So, not $900,000 a year, but they made good money. And I started looking at baseball as a source of aggravation. I didn't think that the sport was fair. And so I wanted to put myself in a position where, I could control my destiny. And so, time passed. My agent eventually calls and says that, hey, the A's are going to be in Baltimore. It's about an hour and a half, 2 hour drive. I got you a workout down there. Go down to Baltimore and throw for them. And, that's what I did.
So this is where shit really starts to change for you. You sign with your hometown team, the A's, as a free agent. You start working on the forkball. You already mentioned Dave Duncan. I think, he's probably a kind of a central figure in this a little bit. But you're back in the Bay. You finish 1986 on a high for you, and then re-sign for 2 more years. What changed for you? And maybe talk about that forkball. Because obviously that was your dominant pitch, moving forward.
Well, forkball was a dominant pitch for me, but really my dominant pitch was fastball command. I could throw my fastball anywhere I wanted to, which made everything else better. I ended up making my first start for Tony and for Dave Duncan against Boston. I ended up winning that start against Roger Clemens, by the way.
Okay.
Dunk asked me what was the pitch that I was throwing. I told him it was a forkball. And he said, did you always have that? I said, yeah, I always had it. I said, but Doug Rader in Texas told me to put it in my back pocket and never throw it again while I was still in Texas. And I said, after that, I found myself in roles where I didn't get an opportunity to use it. So I told him I've always had it. And he encouraged that I continue to throw it. And that kind of turned things around for me. Having that secondary pitch along with okay breaking ball. But I mean the real story is that Dunk taught me how to think baseball, pitching baseball while I was on the mound, recognizing situations, watching hitters, paying attention to what hitters give you, and trusting my gut. And when I learned to do that, it turned everything around.
This is also kind of the point, at least on the public radar, because of, all the success you had. You kind of start to develop that reputation, intimidating, outspoken, a bulldog that pitched deep into games, that you didn't get a chance to when you're in relief, obviously. I read you told Steve Sachs you were going to hit him in the neck. You almost did. How much of the intimidation factor was something that you consciously tried to develop, or was it just natural Dave Stewart on the mound?
It's just natural. Me away from the ballpark and me at the ballpark are two different people. When I got to the ballpark, my day to pitch, I was a very, very mean person. And winning was important. But even above that, maintaining a level of respect with my teammates was the most important thing. And whatever I needed to do to keep that is what I was going to do. And if that meant they hit one of my guys, I hit two of yours, that's what I was going to do. If that meant I get the crap beat out of me in the first inning, but hold them for the other eight, then that's what I'm going to do. But being accountable, being responsible, and leading, not by what I say, but by what I do, those things were important to me. And once I got it, once it was in my grasp, I had it. Once it was in my house, I was never giving it back. And that's how I played the game.
So 1987 is the first year you win 20 games. You go on a run, unbelievable run, both personally and team success. 20 plus games, 4 years in a row, you win. I read a quote from here. Here's a quote from Mickey Telton, who caught you in 1987. He could throw all of his pitches for strikes, and he could throw them anytime he wanted to. He could use his fastball really well inside to right-handers. That was his strong side of the plate. The order of his pitches was probably fastball, his split finger or the fork ball, and his slider. All of them are quality. Is that a correct scouting report from our guy Mickey?
Yeah, it was. And as I said, I had a really good fork ball. But I took extreme pride in the fact that I can throw my fastball anywhere I wanted to, anytime I wanted to, off the plate, on the plate. And I really knew how to use my fastball up in the zone, down in the zone, both sides of the plate. But most people haven't learned that being able to pitch on the plate is great, but being able to pitch off the plate is even better because if you can pitch, especially in on right-handed hitters, you can pitch off the plate and you can double up pitches. It's probably the most effective pitch in baseball.
You must, I mean, obviously fast forwarding a little bit, but that must have been your lesson as a pitching coach. And even today, because fastball command, if you don't have it as a prospect, if you're, trying to, you can't get the heater by guys, it's going to be tough, right? I mean, it's still the most important pitch in baseball.
Without a doubt, fastball, in my opinion, is the best pitch in baseball. And the reason why you see ERAs and you see high pitch counts in today's game is because people don't know how to command a fastball. Constantly behind counts, you're always having high pitch count innings because you can't command your fastball, and most pitchers can't command any pitch. What was impressive about Don Sutton to me, and he may be, as a teammate, the most impressive pitcher I've ever played with. And it was because he could throw his fastball anywhere he wanted to, but he could throw his curveball anywhere he wanted to. And so when you can command two pitches like that, and a breaking ball being the most difficult of the two to command in that way, it's impressive. And obviously, no wonder he's a Hall of Famer. just unbelievable how he commanded his breaking ball on both sides of the plate. It's just unbelievable, and I learned a lot from him.
So 1988, you win 20 games again. You had a front row seat to one of the most iconic moments in baseball history. Not a lot of people remember. You were in line for the win the night Kirk Gibson hit that home run. What sticks out for you about that swing in that game?
Well, I mean, I'll always say, I should have been in the game versus watching the game. And I've told Tony that. No offense to Dennis Eckersley, but I should have been in that game. There was, in my opinion, no reason for me not to be in that game in that situation. I hadn't done anything to not be in that game with my complete game history. There was no reason I shouldn't be in that game. And so, I knew that there was that something wasn't right. There was just a feeling when Eck walked Mike Davis. That walk for me didn't feel good, and it ended up being the situation that put Kirk Gibson. It ended up being what put Kirk Gibson in that situation. And even when it happened, it was hard for me to believe because Eck was. I mean, I don't know what percentage of success he had, but it was a high percentage of success in closing games out. And so, I mean, it was a sad moment. Obviously, it was a sad moment. Mixed emotions for me because I wanted to be in the game at that situation. And then we lost. And on top of that, when you lose a game like that, the other guys, in that case, the Dodgers, they feel like they've got the upper hand. And they ended up going on to beat us.
How big was that rivalry in Cali back in the day?
What made it big is, and Lasorda was good at playing that stuff up, is I think they only won 80, 88, 89 games that year. I don't think they won 90 games. And if I'm not mistaken, we won 100 plus. Everybody was talking about McGuire, Canseco, Parker. I'm sorry, McGuire, Canseco, Lansford, the team that we had, everybody was talking about it. The Bash Brothers was in play. And so what made it the rival is the fact that Lasorda made it a rival. He was good at playing that up, as David beating Goliath. And that's what made it as big as it was.
So the motivational tactics from our guy Tommy worked then.
Sorta was good at that. I played for him, so he was one of the best at making guys bigger than they were.
So you mentioned that, and I was going to ask, Bash Brothers, Rickey Henderson, Eck, just tons of stars. 1989, again, man. I don't know. You seem to play in these iconic World Series, and you win that one. But man. The earthquake. There's a 30 for 30 made on it. Anyone that isn't even of that age, has probably heard about that. What is that experience like, first of all, as a baseball player, but then just as a human being going through that?
I grew up in the Bay, so it wasn't the first earthquake I'd gone through.
Right.
That one, though, we were in the clubhouse, and really we weren't aware that it had even happened. And the clubhouse manager at that time came and he got us and told us we needed to get out of the clubhouse. And we got on the field and we saw all of the people. Our families were already gathered on the field, and they were getting more of our families onto the field and out of the stands. When there's fear, you can hear that in people. Whether it's screams or tears or whatever it is, when something takes place, when a tragedy takes place, you can hear it in the people that are surrounding you. And so we can hear that. And then you think about the first responders that were on the field, and you can hear their walkie-talkies and hear about all the things that are going in the surrounding areas. The marina and the Bay Bridge has collapsed, and the Cypress structure had collapsed. And you can hear all of that. And it puts you in a moment when you're wondering what in the hell is going on. And when you think back, 1989, we didn't have great cellular service. If we had cellular service at all, I don't remember even having a cell phone, quite frankly. And so, now you can't reach your loved ones who are supposed to be at the stadium, but they're not there. It was an ordeal. It really was. It was different than any. Obviously, I'd never been in a 7.1 or 7.2. You had the little 3 points this or 4 points this that just shake and then it's gone, but nothing that destructive. And so it was a crazy experience, and I've never had anything like that since.
So what does it mean to win that one? I asked you about the first one with the Dodgers. That one, probably meant a lot more because I mean, you're the man then.
But you know what? The reason why it meant so much to me is because it was Oakland against San Francisco. I'm from Oakland. There was a lot of bragging going back and forth, a lot of smack talking. And, we lost to the Dodgers the year before. And so to add to the tradition of what was already a great tradition of the A's, I really felt proud that a hometown kid brings a world championship back to his hometown in front of my family, my friends, people I've gone to school with. I mean, the list is on and on of the people and the things that I'd done, coaches that I'd played for. It was huge in that sense because I was able to be an instrumental piece of that accomplishment.
So MVP of that World Series, two gems in that World Series you pitched. 1989 though, do you remember what rookie got you for his first MLB hit in his first MLB game? Double into the left center field gap.
I'm a kid Griffey, man. He talks to me every time I see him. He brings that up. He's a Hall of Famer, and he's still bringing up his first goddamn hit.
I saw that. I mean, the kid's swing though, it was nice. He barreled it up. So what pitch was that?
He had that same swing of fork ball that didn't get down. And it's the one thing about fork ball, bro. If you don't get it down, it's gonna get hit.
Gosman tells me the same thing. So after that season, 2 years, $7 million contract, the largest contract in baseball history at the time, which is really funny to anyone, talking about baseball these days, because I mean, 25 years later, as Arizona Diamondbacks GM, you gave Zach Greinke $206 million. So times change, eh?
Yeah, big time. Back then I never even thought about, how much money that was. People say, well, you should have gone out to be a free agent, would have got more, but I was home, I was happy playing with a good team, playing with great teammates and people that I'd gotten grown to know as family versus teammates. It was the right place for me at that time. And I was glad that I was able to get that deal done.
1990 at Skydome of all places. You spin a no-hitter. What do you remember about that one?
Well, I remember it was the worst warm-up I ever had to start a game. And I remember walking two people in the first inning and getting out of that. And I remember in the fifth inning telling Dave Duncan, my pitching coach, that this is the biggest strike zone that I've ever gotten. And then I just remember going into the ninth inning knowing that I had a no-hitter, going through the hitters and telling myself, which one guy do you not want to hurt you? And it was Junior Felix. He was a power guy as well as a speed guy. We're playing in Toronto on the artificial surface, so if he just barely gets a hold of one or weak ground ball, he could possibly beat it out. And if you groove one, he could hit it out. And so he was the one guy I picked out that I wasn't going to let beat me, or not necessarily beat me because it was 5-0. But he wasn't going to be the guy to break up the no-hitter, and ended up getting to a 3-2 count with him, and I ended up walking him to face Tony Fernandez to end the game. So that's what I remember about it. Most exhausting game I've ever pitched. Mentally,
Why?
just tired. Physically, now I was prepared to do the job. And it's crazy that mentally, I was never able to achieve that same level of concentration ever again in my career. One time. And I don't know how many starts I had in my career, but it's the only time I can remember being that focused in a game.
How'd you celebrate after the game? I don't know what game of the series it was. I don't know if you guys were leaving, but what'd you do? Just sit in the hot tub or what?
Oh man, I did what we normally do, put ice on my shoulder, and elbow, sat in a clubhouse, drink a Labatt's with Carney and Dave and Steiny. That's what we did.
Labatt Blue? What was it?
Labatt's,
Yeah.
yep, that's what it was.
Solid choice. That was my first drink when I was 16 as well. So
It was.
good choice. Good choice.
Yeah.
So 1992, man, you become familiar with Jays fans, and obviously there's a lot of Jays fans that are going to be listening to this one. ALCS, they got the better of you that year. Go on to win the World Series, but you kind of popped on the radar, and then that December you decide to sign in Toronto. So a kid from Oakland, what was it about Toronto that drew you here? And, take me through those negotiations.
The season ended, and as soon as free agency opened, Pat Gillick called, and he said that we're going to try to sign Jimmy Key, and if we sign Jimmy Key, then we probably won't sign you. But if we don't sign Jimmy Key, you're our first choice. And I appreciated the call. I appreciated the honesty. We had talked to the Yankees and a few other teams. To be honest, I didn't want to play in New York. And my gut told me that in New York, they, even with the addition, even if I joined that team, they wouldn't win. And, in 1993, I'm getting old. I am old for what I'm doing as a major league pitcher. And so I wanted one last chance to win and knew I was going to win. And so when I looked at the rotation without me of Jack Morris and Stottlemyre and Guzman and Henkin, I felt that that was the place to be. I've never looked at offense as being the deciding factor. I looked at pitching. You had Dwayne Ward and you had Henke in your bullpen in the back end. And so when you look at a setup and a closure like that and a starting rotation, even before I got there, like the rotation they had, for me, that was the deciding factor for me to come to Toronto, along with the fact that the first call Pat Gillick made was to me, and his honesty. That's why I ended up going there.
So you do get that ring, so you knew what you were talking about. In terms of the city, I mean, you grew up in a very racially charged area, as you kind of talked about. What were your initial impressions of Canada and Toronto?
My impressions of Toronto from day one playing in Toronto was that it was a great place to play. The fans early, my earliest memory, were mid early 60s, I mean mid early 80s, and I mean mid late 80s. They were maybe knowledgeable or not, but they were very, very nice to the visiting teams. You come in, they were great fans. They weren't like going to Boston or going to New York, not even close to that. And so I enjoyed the fans. Excuse me. I was getting ready to sneeze, but I guess it didn't come. I enjoyed the fans. When I threw the no-hitter and more fans were chanting, more fans were cheering for me than the home team just to see the no-hitter.
Yeah.
Knew that it was a place that I would want to play. But even from that, you take them out of the ballpark and just the city, just beautiful people and the different ethnic groups that were in Toronto at that time. The cleanliness of the city, restaurants on every corner, good eating. Those were the things for me that sealed the deal.
So I asked you about, starting the game of the Kirk Gibson home run. This time the big home run goes your way. You actually started the game, the final game, Joe Carter. First of all, what do you remember about that moment? Where were you sitting? What was your reaction?
I was in the clubhouse. I'd been taken out of the game. I was in the clubhouse. I was iced down. And, I thought this, Joe won't admit it, but I think a lot of us were thinking this. When Mitch came into the game, we knew we had a chance to win that game. He was wild, could not command the strike zone. And made a lot of mistakes. And so when you make a lot of mistakes, although he was a high velocity guy, but when you make a lot of mistakes, yeah, it's true. You can probably get away with mistakes when you throw hard, but with a good hitter, that makes all the difference in the world. And now you're facing Joe Carter, who in my mind should be a Hall of Famer. With all the 100 RBI seasons, consecutive RBI seasons, it was the right situation to win that baseball game.
So the strike happens. You retire in the middle of 1995. Take me through that. Just deciding to walk away, because that's obviously a monumental decision in any player's career.
I mean, I would have retired after the 94 season, which was my plan. My contract with Toronto, in my mind, was my last contract. We went on strike, and by all right, I still should have retired because I lost an emotion for the game that carried me, quite frankly, for 16 years. I loved baseball. I was in love with baseball, and when we went on strike, it really took a lot out of me for the game. I let Todd Stottlemyre talk me into playing another year, quite frankly. We were both in Homestead at the Homestead camp for free agents. Todd got signed by the A's, and then shortly after that, I got signed by the A's. But even when we were in that Homestead camp, we were talking about, playing, and he's talking about playing, I'm talking about going home, and he talked me into that. And so you start off the season back in Oakland playing with a bunch of different guys. They're younger guys. McGuire, I think, was still a part of that team. And Mac is the only real person that I can remember, quite frankly, that was a part of my first teams. And it was just a different place, different atmosphere, different. And I never really got that juice that I had before to play the game, and my numbers showed it. And so we got further in the season, but I think it was even halfway through the year, a team that I had a great lifetime record against, the Milwaukee Brewers. They scored 10 runs off of me in less than 2 innings. I think it was an inning and two thirds. And then I knew it was time. And I remember coming in a clubhouse and Eck was in there. He was smoking a cigarette. And I told him, I said, I'm going home. He says, "Who do you mean you're going home? We still got more road trip left." And then he looked at me and he knew what I meant. And I ended up telling Tony closer to what was supposed to be my next start, that I was going to retire. And he tried to talk me out of it, thought it was premature, but it was the right decision. My heart wasn't in it, and it was time for me to go home.
So all these years later, you're comfortable with kind of how it ended?
You know, you can always be. I wasn't comfortable with how it ended. It would have ended if I would have, if it would have been, the end would have been in Philadelphia. But this time it was my call, and it was the right call. And it was respectful to baseball, what I did. When you can't perform at a certain level in this game, it's really not about money. It's about respect and respect for the game. And the level that I was performing was not respect for the baseball. And so it was the right call. And I don't look back at it today and say, God, I wish I'd have hung around another year. I was 39 years old. You know, I got as much out of my tank as I could.
And you move quickly, you know, kind of into the front office stuff. You kind of didn't make it a secret that you wanted to be a front office guy. You wanted to be a GM. You fell into a couple pitching coach roles, including here in Toronto in 2000, I believe. But then you're passed over. You wanted the Blue Jays GM job. You passed over for JP Ricciardi. You kind of had some pointed remarks about racism at the time. Just how close do you think you became to being the Blue Jays GM at that point?
Well, I think I came real close. Paul Godfrey said there wasn't going to be a second round. So after the first round, I was the leading candidate. And then something changed his mind to interview JP Ricciardi, who, and I said it then, I'll say it now, he put two resumes on the table. His didn't even compare to mine back then, and they gave him the job. It didn't make sense to me. What did make sense to me is what I stated, which I thought it was racially motivated. You know, I resigned my position and I moved on. It was a slap in the face. And then Paul Godfrey asked me if I would stay on and help this guy. what was that? You know, so now, once again, I made the right decision. I got out.
So you go start a sports agency, negotiate some huge, huge contracts, including Eric Chavez, who was one of my favorite players. I don't know, maybe it's because I'm bald now, but I wasn't bald back in the day. But, you know, the guy was so smooth at third base. He had that hair. I'm pretty sure he's a California kid too, if I'm not mistaken.
Diego kid, yep.
Yeah, one of my favorite players back in the day. September 2014, you finally get that GM role with the D-backs. I talked about that, the Greinke contract. That lasted 2 years. And actually, one guest we had on the show back this summer in July was Orlando O-Dog Hudson. And he kind of gave you a lot of credit for getting the D-backs to kind of where they are today. How do you view that tenure as GM? And, you know, if you could do that over again, would you do anything differently?
Well, I wouldn't do it any differently. I did it the only way I knew how. And under the circumstances that I came into that job with bad contracts and low budget, I tried to make changes in a way that I could make changes. If there's anything I would do different, I wished I had more control of my situation. You know, I came into that job working for Tony La Russa, Derek Hall, and Ken Kendrick. But, you know, truth be told, I knew more about office management than Tony did, but I was being directed by him. And you know, it wasn't tough at the time, because if it wasn't for him, I wouldn't have the job. But you know, I did the job as best I could under the circumstances. I think I did a great job. I didn't have a great relationship with the owner. And I was fired. But, you know, in 2017, they went to the playoffs. So that's an indication of the job that I did, because when I got there, you know, no offense to Kevin Towers, because Kevin Towers is did a great job in a for a lot of years for a lot of teams. He did a great job. I just wasn't I wasn't left with a lot when I took that position, and I changed things drastically. I made that team a contending team in 2 years.
Do you hope to be a GM again? Where does Dave Stewart kind of look at, the front office? The job has changed a lot. It's a lot of analytics guys. There's not a lot of former players as GMs anymore.
My sights are on ownership now. I want to own a team. And, as we spoke early on, I want to own it and build it the way an organization should be built. I want to be the guy to hire the people in their positions and build a culture and build winning. That's what I want to do at this point. And, I'm comfortable with where I am at this place and time in my life. And when you look at anybody else that's out there, nobody has done what I've done in the game of baseball, in the different positions in the game. And so the evolution is to be in ownership next.
It's an extensive resume, man. That's why I've kept you here for over an hour. So really appreciate the time. I gotta ask the last question I'm gonna leave you with, because I got a boring ass name, Scott Mitchell. I think Smoke Mitchell would sound kind of cool, actually. How the hell did you get that nickname, and who gave that to you?
Named Tack Wilson, man. I played Little League baseball with him, and I was catcher, and the guy was stealing a base, and I didn't even get out of my crouch. I threw straight from my knees. And I'm never going to pretend that I threw so hard down the second base that it hurt his hand. What I will say is I threw the ball, and I hit him in the right spot in his glove that hurt his hand. And when he took his glove off, he said, "Woo, smoke. Man, you threw the hell out of that ball. Smoke, you threw that ball hard." So we got past that. He started calling me Smoke after that. But then I get drafted by the Dodgers in 75. He gets drafted by the Dodgers in 76. Hadn't been called Smoke since we played Babe Ruth ball together. So we're talking 15 years old. He's in the clubhouse. I didn't know he had been drafted. And I hear from the other side of the clubhouse, "Smoke! Hey, Smoke!" And the whole clubhouse started calling me Smoke. And so Smoke came back to life, and I kept it.
Man, I wish I had someone like that around me to find a cool nickname. Just didn't have that. But Smoke, I really appreciate this, man, and good luck with everything in Nashville. I hope the next time we're speaking, we're talking about a new franchise there. And hey, man, really appreciate this time.
Okay, Scott, you take care, bro.
So one of the things I find the most fun so far about this show is putting our SMS chain on our guests and seeing the reaction. And that piece is designed and made by Lessard Coutu Jewelry, our second sponsor. You can find them at lcjewelry.com. And then on Instagram at Lessard Coutu Jewelry, you can tap into Scotty Mitch Show on Instagram. Just go to our follows. You'll find all our sponsors right there. But if you want to get some drip, some ice, some bling, go see my guy Nick at Lessard Coutu Jewelry. You can check out everything online. You can send Nick a direct message on their Instagram. Everything from diamond rings, bracelets, gold grills, pinky rings. And you can already check out his work with our chain. Jay Onwright's been wearing it. Sean Lemon's been wearing it. It's everywhere because I'm really proud of the logo we designed. And then Nick made it come to life. So you can go. They've been serving the Niagara region for over 30 years. They also have a pop-up shop in Yorkville. If you'd like a local piece, DM Nick, go have a scotch at their shop in Yorkville, and I promise you'll be taken care of for your next piece. That's Lessard Coutu Jewelry at lcjewelry.com.
Pleasure right now to be joined by an old friend, Kevin Pillar. Nobody needs to be introduced to this guy with my listenership. Highlight reel catches, big part of what was going on here a long time ago. Kevin, thank you for joining the show. How is Arizona treating you right now?
Arizona's great. I mean, it's my first opportunity to have spring training here. I've lived here for the last 6 years, so Getting these extra 6 weeks at home has been a dream come true. Sleeping in my own bed, getting to take my kids to their, activities after I get home from the fields. There's nothing better.
You mentioned kids. You're 35 years old now. We're all getting old. How has life changed for you personally over the last few years since, Blue Jays fans last kind of saw you?
Well, I mean, a lot's changed. I mean, when I left Toronto, I just had my first kid. Kobe was still a baby. I also only had ever played for the Blue Jays until I left there. Now I'm on my eighth team. I got Kobe six. My son's about to be four. Life is so much different. Baseball has become more of a job than I would say my entire life. My kids have definitely helped me with that, where I can leave baseball at the field and come home, and the expectations for me to be dad. There was a big part of my life where, my job and baseball followed me everywhere I went, whether I wanted it or not. The good and the bad. It's easy to come home after being successful or doing something successful in the field and kind of basking in that glory and, sharing that moment or moments, with my wife or, my friends that were in town or teammates or family that was in town. But with this job also comes the dark and the bad, and taking that home. Looking back on it, was probably not the easiest for my wife, especially my wife who was with me the whole time, but also, my friends or family that were in town visiting too. So a lot has changed, for the better. But it's crazy to be sitting here thinking I'm going to be entering my 10th professional season. I'll be able to get 10 years of service time this year. Something I thought would be it was beyond my wildest imagination when I started the journey.
So you hit on a number of topics there, interesting topics that I have on a list to get to. First of all, explain to somebody that doesn't understand, what 10 years of service time means, for your future and your family's future.
Well, I mean, I know a lot of people that maybe, or a lot of people in the baseball world, might not understand just like the way, our pension works. It gets fully vested after 10 years. But like at this point, being 100 days shy, like I could walk away from the game and my pension's roughly going to be the same amount with the amount of service time that I've accomplished. 10-year marker is more about, I guess, the rarity that it's achieved, and it's just kind of the gold standard for durability and longevity in our game, where, like I mentioned, I don't know the exact number of people that put a uniform on, but I know it's somewhere between 0 and 5% of players that ever play in the big leagues will reach 10 years of service time. So to be knocking on that door, with no guarantees this year, taking a non-roster invite with the White Sox, it's something that motivates me every day to kind of just put all my chips on the table this year, go all in, whatever it takes, to make this team and try to accomplish that goal.
So you mentioned that, I think everybody knows your kind of journey. I mean, 32nd round pick, a guy that, essentially wasn't supposed to make the big leagues. What is that like, kind of reflecting on that now? Because it sounds like, you're at the age with a family and things like that you do reflect on it a little bit. And I know younger players try not to think of that. They try not to think of the future. It's day by day. You guys work in a day by day sport. What is that like, just being able to reflect on it a little bit and kind of appreciate it while you're still in it?
Yeah, I mean, I do that quite often. I mean, I would say, especially 2 years ago, when I got an opportunity to play for the Dodgers, my hometown team, and only got a chance to play four games, and I had a serious shoulder injury, really the first major injury I had in my entire professional career, something that kept me out indefinitely, is when I really had a chance to kind of sit back and reflect on my career, the things that I've been able to do, where this journey started, and really just have an appreciation for it. I try to keep that in mind when I'm, kind of faced with a little bit of adversity or a little bit of a challenge, as this opportunity that's presented itself this year with the White Sox coming in as a non-roster invite with no guarantees, having to make the team where it feels like pressure could amount, especially not getting off to the best start statistically in spring training. I try to rely on, where I've come from and how much I've overcome to allow me to just kind of go out there, trust my ability, trust my work, have a peace of mind, and knowing that, in some weird way, I'm not really supposed to be here. I was never supposed to make it. I've accomplished a lot more than I ever thought I would accomplish in my career. And not to say I use that as a way, an excuse, or as a way to, maybe brace myself, or if what I'm wanting to happen doesn't happen, it's just a way of being at peace with everything and not putting so much pressure on, every single at bat or every single moment I'm at the field, to know that I've accomplished great things, that I have a track record of playing in the big leagues, and that holds some weight. But more than anything, to just have a peace of mind going in every single day that I'm in a bonus round. I've played a lot longer than I ever thought I would imagine when I started this journey. But there was definitely points that during my career when I don't want to say it was ever easy for me, but I would say when I was established in Toronto and I was getting an opportunity to play every day and I was playing well, there was definitely a point in time where I thought I would play baseball till, they would rip the uniform off me, or I thought I would reach 10 years, without a doubt. I thought maybe to some degree it would be smooth sailing. But that's not everyone's journey. That wasn't my journey. When I left Toronto, it kind of seemed more of an uphill battle every year to get jobs, to get guaranteed jobs, and then just to get jobs, and then to have to kind of prove my worth and my value every single year. But I think it's definitely made me a stronger person. I think it's allowed me to deal with a lot of, adversity. I think it's put my back up against the wall many times, and I've been able to succeed. And I think these are all things that, as my kids get older, these are all different, journeys and chapters of my life that I'll be able to share them. And, in some way, I'll be able to tell them that I've been in their shoes, or I've been in positions that or adversity that they may be going through in their individual lives, and be able to share how I was able to come out of those things and be successful in the end.
So you kind of touched on the main point of what this conversation, when I asked you to come on the show, is about, is you were the everyday guy. You mentioned that. I'm curious because I've covered different sports, and sometimes the hardest transition isn't the one out of the game. It's the one from star guy, everyday guy, vital part of a team, into a role player. And I'm curious for you, because that's the transition you started to make, and I guess probably 2020, just after the pandemic. You mentioned a few things there, but mentally, how much did you have to adjust your day to day when that started to happen?
Yeah, I mean, it kind of, for me, it was kind of weird. It kind of felt like it happened overnight. I left Toronto, I went to San Francisco, I got opportunity to play every day. In my mind, at least in my mind, statistically, I thought it was my best season in the big leagues. I thought it was my most complete season.
Hey,
You know,
you
I
got an
drove in.
MVP vote, man. You got an MVP vote.
Yeah, a lot of people, you know, that was a very, I don't want to say controversial because that would not be an appropriate word for it, but I know the guy who voted for me was obviously a writer in San Francisco. And I had an opportunity to talk to him and obviously didn't feel worthy of an MVP vote, but he had an opportunity to explain to me why I did it. And I think it made sense. And, you know, it was a very, insignificant, meaningless vote, but I think it was just his way of paying respect for what I was able to do in San Francisco, being traded over and then basically leading the team in every statistical category for the offensive side, which weren't the, you know, weren't unbelievable statistics, but I think it just kind of showed the I guess that year, the difficulty the San Francisco Giants had manufacturing and producing runs. And, you know, for me to be able to drive in a lot of them and score a lot of them and lead the team in homers and doubles, I think it was just his way of showing respect. But on that topic, that's kind of where I felt like, in the industry's eyes, my ability to play center field and to play every day kind of diminished overnight. You know, going from that year where, like I said, I received an MVP vote and I also felt like I had a really good statistical season. I was non-tendered, you know, probably for financial reasons, but that made sense going into my last year arm. Thought it was a blessing, thought I was going to be you know, I was able to become a free agent a year earlier and thought that, you know, I was going to be in a position to sign a multi-year deal with a team and for the first time in my career, not have to stress about the following season, kind of be able to establish a new home somewhere and allow my family to kind of settle in somewhere. And that never really happened. I was not able to, you know, find a team or sign until really late in spring training. I think pitchers and catchers have already reported, and I think it was when Mookie Betts got traded to LA, there kind of became a void in the outfield in Boston. And, you know, my number was called, and I think even with that, I was going out there with an opportunity to be more of a platoon guy than I was an everyday guy. And, you know, at that point, I didn't, my mindset never really changed, you know, even in that season. And I don't think it still has changed. I still went in there preparing for the opportunity to play every day. And, you know, unfortunately, someone got hurt. And I was able to play every day in Boston and then traded to Colorado, got a chance to play every day. You know, thought I was able to, you know, prove to teams I could still do that. You know, got an opportunity to sign with the Mets as an extra outfielder. And initially, I was in a role of, it wasn't even a platoon role. I was kind of just in an extra outfield role. And injuries happened. And once again, I stayed ready for my opportunity, got a chance to play pretty frequently. And then 2022 is kind of when, you know, not in a dramatic way, but I would say kind of my life changed a little bit where for the first time in 8 years, I was not able to, for whatever reason, I was not able to, you know, receive a big league job and took a step back and signed with my hometown team with the Dodgers, you know, but more importantly, a team that historically over the last, you know, decade or so has had a lot of success with maybe guys that have underperformed, or guys that were maybe not as known, and was able to kind of get them in their quote unquote lab and, kind of revamp their swing or revamp their approach or whatever they do over there. I don't want to get into details of what they do over there, but whatever they do over there works. And, I got an opportunity to go into camp for, 2.5 weeks, signing kind of late and get into their lab and work on some things. And, the communication with them was really good. I knew I was going to make the team out of camp, so there was no pressure for me to have to go out into spring training, games, and perform. It was really about trying to kind of fine-tune my swing and my moves and the way I was approaching the ball. And knowing I was going to get an opportunity, at least a month to go down to AAA and kind of work on it. And, went down to AAA and, felt like I found the best version of myself, at least from the offensive standpoint, and had an opportunity to come back, and, had the shoulder injury, which cost me the whole year. But, I learned a lot in that injury during that time during my rehab. I really questioned if I still wanted to play baseball, or if that injury was kind of going to just be the way for me to just, I don't think anyone would have blamed me for, walking away from the game after that injury, after, overachieving my entire career, for laying my body on the line, every time I went on the field, for my body to finally kind of fail me. I think, anyone that had watched me play or anyone that had followed me in my career, would have been like, it was about time, that, he had an injury for the way that he played. I wouldn't blame him if he walked away, but, I found a lot of, I found a lot of peace in my rehab and my journey and being able to come back a lot sooner than people thought I would come back. And I think I also kind of re kind of fell in love with, I don't necessarily know if I ever fell out of love with baseball, or I didn't fall back in love, but I think I fell back in love with the challenges that baseball presents. And I guess the small victories you could find in every single day during the rehab process. And, for me, setting a goal where, the timetable was about 9 months to come back from the injury I had. And in some sick way, I felt like I needed to come back in 3 to just kind of give myself an opportunity to go back, and play some games in AAA at the end of the year. And more importantly, try to put myself on the map for the Dodgers that were going to the playoffs, that I could be an option for them when they got to the playoffs. But I think more importantly, I wanted to prove to a lot of these teams that I was healthy going into that following off season, that it wouldn't be impossible for me to find a job the following year if I wanted to play, without having to go play winter ball somewhere. So I was able to kind of accomplish that. And, fortunately, I was able to, get on the phone with Alex last year and get an opportunity to go reunite with him in Atlanta. And I think that's where I really fell in love with baseball again, truly fell in love with every part of it last year. And it was honestly the most, it was the easiest year in terms of showing up to the field every day with that group of guys over there and the expectation we are going to win every day. But it was definitely the first time in my career truly that I was not ever going to play every day, no matter how successful I was on the field. I was strictly, I had a role. It was to face left-handed pitching when they started games, and pinch hit for a certain player if a left-handed came in a certain situation of the game, and that was it. And I found it to be very, very, at the end of the season, I look back on it and I found it to be very, very challenging and very, very difficult. But had an appreciation for it, and feel like going into this year, if that's kind of what my destiny is, I will be much better prepared for not, you know, and there was certain times last year I would go, you know, 10 to 17 days without a single at bat and then be asked to pitch in or asked to start a game. And, you know, without making excuses for myself, I had to find ways to be able to try to be successful. And baseball is so predicated on repetition and timing, and to go that many days without it, found it very difficult. And I found throughout the year, I found better ways to stay physically and mentally prepared for those opportunities. But I think throughout all this, in this long-winded answer, I think my mindset every year remains the same, the way that I train every off-season. You know, the hell I put my through the hell I put myself through every off season in my training, is still with the mindset that in some weird way, I still feel like I could play every single day if given the opportunity. I don't know if that's my destiny here, but I also want to be prepared for if I get that opportunity. I don't want to be limited by, you know, lack of training or lack of physicality or lack of mental preparation if that opportunity does present itself. So I still go into every season with the mindset that I'm hoping someone gives me a chance to earn a job and run with the job. And if that comes with 500 at-bats, I'll be prepared for it. If that comes with, you know, a similar role to what I had last year in Atlanta with 200 bats, I will also be prepared for that as well.
Just for the sake of detail here, the shoulder injury you suffered, fractured left shoulder, sliding into third base in a game. I will say, man, you touched on it. It's absolutely fucking amazing that you were able to stay on the field while you were in Toronto as much as you did. You know, I don't need to explain to anybody, you know, crashing into the wall, rug burns, you know, diving, you know, just playing the game at 100 all the time. And, you know, I look at your game logs. I mean, 2015, 159 games, 2016, 146, 2017, 154, 2018, 142, 2019, 161. So, I mean, with the way you play, it's pretty amazing. It took that long to have, you know, a setback like that. And I want to go back to April 2nd, 2019. You probably obviously remember that day very well. I remember it very well. Kendrys Morales had been traded a few days earlier. It was kind of obvious that, you know, all of the key pieces from 2015, 2016 were moving on at that point, and a few already had. Do you remember the emotion of that day? Because I know you were very surprised when we talked to you, and you came out and talked to us just outside the clubhouse down in the Rogers Center. Take me back to the emotion of that day.
Yeah, I mean, you touched on some of it. I mean, you know, I always saw the writing on the wall in terms of, you know, the band was going to break up at some point, and it started, you know, probably, so we went to playoffs in 16 or 15, 16, 17. You know, I felt like that's kind of when, you know, some key pieces of the team, maybe some of the older pieces were, you know, not sticking around. But in some weird way, I thought I was different. I thought I was, you know, part of the old core, but I also thought that I was going to be a guy that, you know, Ross and Mark, you know, believed in, and Charlie believed in as, you know, part of the nucleus moving forward. And I felt like that was kind of, you know, without them using those words, I kind of felt like that was the feel that I got, especially in that spring training, going in, being one of the older guys, kind of being one of the more veteran guys in camp that year, a guy that had, you know, drafted and developed and succeeded with Toronto. You know, I felt like I was part of that nucleus going forward. So to receive that phone call the morning of April 2nd was about as shocked as anyone could be in this game. It as emotional as any player could probably be in this game. I would say there was slight confusion. I wouldn't say there's probably a lot more feelings in the moment. Looking back on it, I would say those are probably the main two or three things that I was feeling. I'm probably scared a little bit too, would probably be up there too, but I'm pretty sure, I don't remember if it was an off day or not, or it
Yeah,
was
it
definitely a Monday.
was. I believe it was an off day.
It was either an off day or it was a Monday morning where we had just wrapped up opening series. I remember vividly too, me, my wife, and Kobe, who was still just a baby. After the game on Sunday, went to Yorkville, went to Whole Foods. You know, really just started to kind of get ourselves locked in to our new place. You know, unpacked and everything, and went there and bought our groceries for, you know, the upcoming week. And then also we were about to go on the road, so just wanted to make sure my wife and Kobe had everything they needed while I went on the road. I forgot what I was doing. I was going to do some sort of off the field appearance or podcast or something, and I had just left my place, and I got down the road maybe two blocks and my phone rang and it was Ross. And I don't remember if I felt like some like this was gonna happen, or I felt like, I don't really know what my feeling was. I just felt like it was odd that I was getting a call from Ross at that point in time in the morning. And I felt like I didn't even remember what he said. I just remember he said, you know, I was going to San Francisco, I got traded. I remember tapping my Uber driver or my car service, whatever I had, on the shoulder. I said, can you just turn around, take me back? And I remember going up to my place, and my wife asked me if I forgot something, and told her, I think I just got traded to the Giants, San Francisco, and I have to leave now, and I'm going to LA. And you know, for someone that had only ever played in Toronto and never got traded, I had no idea what to do or what was expected or what I was gonna do. And I was definitely a player who was very open and honest about his love and his appreciation for playing in Toronto, and you know, kind of felt like that's something I wanted to do for as long as I was going to get an opportunity to do it. And it kind of just, I mean, it was emotional. You know, I love being in Toronto, I love being a part of that organization. I had an appreciation with all the cool, unique opportunities I got through the winter tour to travel the country and just see how important the Blue Jays were across the entire Canada. And I also was there during a time when Toronto baseball, the Blue Jay baseball was kind of an afterthought. It was kind of dead, and I had an opportunity to take that place from being empty to selling out to winning a division to hosting playoff games. And you know, I saw how much it meant to the people and how much it meant to the city, and I took great appreciation in that. And to get traded, especially that early in the year when you never expected to happen, was just super emotional and super, you know, just so many emotions. And back on it, you know, I see how difficult it was for my wife and basically a newborn at that point. But in hindsight, I realized how much that prepared me for what the rest of my baseball journey was going to be like, to learn how to walk into a new clubhouse and you know, meet a bunch of new guys and kind of learn how to you know, kind of learn how to fit in and kind of learn how to be yourself right away. As opposed to kind of just tiptoeing around, learning how to make new friends. You know, I think that's the thing that people don't understand is they just kind of assume you go into a clubhouse and, you know, every single person gets along. You have the same interests and the same life. You got to come in and you got to, you know, most importantly, be yourself, and you got to, you know, not try to be anyone else. And through that, you'll learn to find people that, you know, think the same way you think, you know, appreciate what you bring to the table. You find your common ground with people and you make friends.
And looking back on that opportunity to go, especially that early in the year, to, basically, I played opening day in Toronto and I played opening day in San Francisco. So, it was a full season without the ability for me to go into spring training, establish relationships with the coaching staff or players. That was probably equally as hard for me as, the actual getting traded, but just going into a new place and trying to figure out who am I going to spend time with on the road and who am I going to hang out with, or who am I going to do anything with, and how am I going to establish a relationship with this hitting coach?
So you say all that, and with the benefit of 8, 9 years of hindsight now, I'm always curious, and I asked a couple of the guys this, at the Jose Bautista induction this year, is how do you view now 2015 and 2016? Is it with just complete joy and excitement of the memories, or are you just like, damn, so close?
No, I think it's both. I think it's obviously so much joy, so much pride, so much I mean, I'm obviously biased. I don't think anything is gonna replace winning a World Series, but in some ways, I think especially 2015, could be argued as the most important season in Toronto baseball history. Just in the sense that baseball was dead there for so long. And I feel like we were able to accomplish something. We weren't able to accomplish the ultimate goal, but I think we accomplished the ability to kind of just revitalize baseball in Toronto and across Canada. And I take a lot of pride in that. And I say that, not guessing, but knowing, just from my experience of traveling, across the country, shortly after that time, what the success we had those couple years.
Oh, what's going on?
How you guys doing? Doing. How those, those, like I said, those seasons really just, especially on the youth side, like made kids want to play baseball again. And, but yeah, there's obviously some disappointment in it too. I felt like, especially 2015, it felt like we had a team to win a World Series. But and personally, I felt like just those 2 years too, I felt like, I don't want to say it was easy, but I felt like that was kind of my destiny, was to be a player that was going to be a guy that was going to play in the postseason every single year. And it took me almost 8 years to get back last year with Atlanta. So I think going into that playoff year, I had just such a last year I had such a appreciation for what our team was able to accomplish, and realize the difficulty it is of getting to the playoffs.
Yeah, all truth there. We'll wrap up on this. Since you've been in Florida, Arizona, up close, appreciate you taking us, through your drive from home to the White Sox facility today. But what is the ideal spring training setup, Florida or Arizona? Quickly.
Well, I think I mean, obviously get an opportunity to go home every single day, sleep in my own bed, be a part of my kids' life, not have to uproot their lives, that wouldn't change. But I do still think I'm partial to Florida spring training. I feel like
Interesting.
Florida's, although the as you early on, when you're one of the guys and you're a little bit more spoiled in spring, you're not making the long journeys. When you're a guy fighting for a job, you make the long journeys, and that kind of sucks. But I will say there is more of a emphasis on the actual game in Florida, because you don't have the ability to, here in Arizona, you can play a game, the furthest drive you're going to make is 40 minutes. So you can have a full workout, get in the car and drive. And by the end of the day, by the time the game starts, you're friggin' worn out from the whole day workout. In Florida, a lot of times you could just leave from home, drive an hour and a half to a game, show up, hit BP on the field, play catch. And there's definitely some importance on the game. Here, it's make sure you get all your work in, check all the boxes. And then on top of it, you still got to go out and compete, play a game. But I wouldn't trade it. I get to go home every day, so I'm blessed.
We're all blessed, buddy. Kevin Pillar, thank you very much for joining the show. I will always appreciate you. I know Blue Jays fans will always appreciate you, and good luck in the future, my man.
I appreciate it. Good catching up. Thanks for having me.